This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Back in the 1980s, the United Nations tried to define the term sustainability, saying that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Since then, a more catchy phrase has emerged, going green, shorthand for everything from fervent recycling to rooftop solar. But along with going green has come greenwashing, the pretense of being environmentally friendly purely for public relations. Today in The Exchange, sussing out sustainability. When is it real? When is it just a label? Let's hear from you. Your thoughts, questions are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests in the studio. Sam Evans Brown is here, NHPR's environment reporter and host of NHPR's show Outside In, a program about the natural world and how we use it. And Sam, good to see you as always.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, Michael Bellamente. He's head of the Green Alliance, a platform connecting green consumers with green businesses. And Michael Bellamente, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Later on, guys, we'll hear from several Granite State businesses that are really trying hard to take the sustainable route. So, Sam, I just gave that UN definition of sustainability. What's your best definition?
I think that, you know, it's actually funny that we talk about definitions because sustainability has been used so broadly that there's this risk that it actually becomes meaningless because people will apply it to whatever it is that their issue that they're working on is. And so what I would encourage people to think about is if they're buying something, a product that's being labeled as sustainable, what is the problem that that product is trying to solve? Is it something having to do with energy? Is it something having to do with, you know, habitat impacts? Is it having to do with pollution or water impacts? Because there's undoubtedly some sort of problem that they are trying to deal with, and they've got some sort of solution that has led them to apply this label of sustainable. But then it's really incumbent on the consumer to figure out, A, what is this company doing and that has led them to adopt the label, and B, what are they trying to solve?
So look at the goal in a critical way, Sam, and don't just accept the whole kahuna, if I could put it that way. You know,
right. I mean, sustainable has been used for so many applications. I mean, so what are we talking about when we say that word?
What do you think, Michael?
I agree with Sam. I would add to that we live in an era, we live in a time that we obviously world population is growing to 9 billion by 2050, and we live in a world of finite resources. And the truth is we need a healthy economy. People need jobs. People need food. People need shelter. But we can't have these things coming at the cost of the environment. To the degree that we're depleting all of our resources. So sustainability to me means very much in line with what the UN says is we have to meet the needs of today without sacrificing the needs of the future. With that in mind, it becomes clear also that you can say sustainability or something sustainable, but if you're buying it, if we're living in consumptive culture, which we are, a throwaway society, that light bulb could be as sustainable as it can be, and we're still needing it, and we're still using it. So the idea is to consume less at some point, or to just figure out how to make it what's called the circular economy. So all of those outputs, the waste becomes resources for inputs and parts of raw materials for new products.
So talk a little bit more about that, Michael. If I buy a plastic bottle of, you know, dishwashing liquid or one of those huge heavy-duty jugs of clothes washing liquid, I'm feeling okay about it because I recycle it. Is that sustainable?
Oh, you're delving into something deep.
A whole show right there.
Right,
recycling.
Exactly,
Sam
right.
And I have done that. But.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, again, everybody needs to do their own part. And I think most often people put it on the parts of companies to say, you know, and I hear it all the time, oil companies, bad, bad, bad. Well, you're driving your car to work. I mean, what are you doing? What's your place in it? So there's all of these measures a person can take. And I absolutely agree. You know, if you're recycling that big plastic jug, that's the right thing to do. But also look at the type of dishwashing detergent or laundry detergent that you're using in the first place. And I tell you, there's one out there that I love. It's called Method. And it's four pumps, one load. So you don't have to deal with a cup that has this very tough-to-read line. And the reason that Tide puts those very tough-to-read lines in there is so they can have their users just fill it up to the top every time and they'll buy more product. That's not sustainable in my mind. So
recycling, is it sustainable? Does that make a product more sustainable?
It does because, again, it can be those outputs get recycled into something else that can be used for another product. At the same time, you can only recycle a product so many times, and then something has to go to landfill because that downcycled material isn't worth anything. There's no commodity to it at some point. Well, aluminum besides.
Sam, go ahead.
I think Laura, that question really gets to the fact that, sustainability as a word is a spectrum of behaviors. There are things that can be considered more sustainable than another thing. But saying, quote unquote, is this sustainable? It's really hard to say yes or no. It's really relative to other behaviors that you're comparing these things.
And there's a lot of judgment inherent in this too, Sam, right? I mean, some people would say, yay, recycling, you know, that's sustainable. Other people would say, no, 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 you shouldn't have used it in the first place.
Exactly. And I think that, again, that gets to sort of where on the spectrum are you? And so there are people who this is and all they think about day in and day out is how can I reduce my impact? And of course, for those people, anyone who's not doing the same as them is, you know, not there. They're not doing enough.
Yeah. So again, the judgment and the range, 50 Shades of Green.
Yeah,
Michael.
Love it. There you go. That could be a book.
What do you think? The range. The range of sustainability. I mean, for me, it's one thing. You know, it's recycling my silly dishwashing liquid. For you, it's probably a lot more.
Not so much, actually. my wife would tell you it's she says for a green guy, I'm not as green as probably I should be. And that's what I mean by that is I've come into this space as I would consider myself an average American dude that just wants to do the right thing, but it's pretty lazy when it comes time to actually do it. And yeah, I'm pretty cheap at times when I'm not going to spend, you know, a premium on a toilet paper that is half as comfortable as Charmin. You know, I mean, like there's degrees of what I'm willing to give up as well. And what my thing has always been is if we're going to reach that golden triangle of sustainability, it's going to have to be cost comparative. So you're not going to have to spend more. It's going to be quality comparative. It's going to have the same level of quality as the alternative. And it's going to be fashion and taste comparative to what else is out there, right? So you have to get to a point where the products we're buying that are more sustainable are at par, on even par, with what's already out there from the traditional sense. So I want to move that needle to get to the point that those innovators are really the ones that are winning. And that's what Green Alliance is about. That's what Naked Bullfrog, this platform we're building, is about, is just telling people who's innovating and pushing the direction that says, hey, stupid easy, I know how to buy a more sustainable product because this guy told me.
So you're not coming at this as, you know, a hermit living in a mountain. you know, you're coming at this, as you said, the average American dude who wants to do the right thing but is also a little bit cheap and a little bit lazy.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't say I'm a hermit mostly because I have two little baby girls.
No,
so
I'm
don't
saying
get
you're,
to leave
you're
the
not,
house.
A, you're
no,
not
I'm kidding.
Approaching this as the,
no, no, exactly.
as the hermit on the hill.
I'm absolutely trying to be pragmatic in what resonates with the masses as opposed to just the 10% of people that, you know, will buy that Prius or will do the thing that they think is going to save the environment. Because, I mean, realistically, that's only going to be 10% unless we figure out the bigger play.
Well, I love what you said about that. And, Sam, to you, too. I mean, how many people do you think, consumers, since we're talking about buying products and how we figure out what's real and what's greenwashing, how many people really care? And how many people, as Michael says, you know, kind of care and they'll do the right thing if it's, you know, if it's easy?
Well, I think that 10% number is the one that people point to quite a lot. It depends market by market what products we're talking about. And it's often the price delta is really what's making the difference. I mean, if there's something that's three times as much to buy the organic and the locally grown, then people are less willing to spend versus if it's only 1.5 times as much. But the 10% number is the ballpark figure that gets thrown around.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at environmental sustainability. What's the real deal? And what's public relations greenwashing? What do you think? What have you seen around you in terms of the products that you use? 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Sam Evans Brown is here, NHPR's environment reporter, host of NHPR's show Outside In. Also, Michael Belamente. He's head of the Green Alliance, a platform connecting green consumers with green business. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. So without naming names, Sam, give us a couple examples, or one example just to kick it off, of a product that seems green, but depending on how you measure it, it's not so green.
I'm going to give you two, right? The first one that struck me as a product that is engaged in what we might call greenwashing. I recently got a trial subscription to Blue Apron, which is this company that sends you all of the ingredients for a meal and including these tiny little packets of seasoning, and you make this wonderful gourmet meal in your own home without having to think about how to shop for all these things that you wouldn't normally buy. It comes in a cardboard box. The cardboard box is lined with big, thick ice packs that come pre-frozen. It's insulated, and then it's got all these individually wrapped ingredients inside of it. And then right on the inside of the box, this blew me away, it says, all of this packaging is sustainable packaging.
Yeah.
and you know, I have to say, I'm not to go after Blue Apron. This is clearly a point of contention for them because, you know, I had my free sample. I canceled my free sample right after. And in the little questionnaire that you have to fill out to cancel, it says, why are you canceling? And one of the boxes you can check is too much packaging. So this is clearly a sore point for them. And I think they are trying. However, this is a decision that by signing on to Blue Apron versus just going to the grocery store and getting things in larger quantities, you are inherently making a less sustainable choice. There's more packaging involved that has to be thrown out or recycled. And as Mike alluded to, recycling, you're frequently not returning it to. It's not like you take this little plastic cup and it makes another little plastic cup. It's often called downcycling. It's eventually winds up in a landfill anyway.
Becomes something smaller and less valuable?
Right, exactly. So that's one example. I mean, this is a company that's trying, and they've labeled themselves as sustainable, and I would argue that it is a less sustainable choice. However, I just spent the weekend grading all sorts of businesses in New Hampshire in this Sustainability Slam competition that I'm a judge for.
Sustainability Slam?
Yes, yes. And there's all these companies in New Hampshire that are trying lots of things. And one that rose to the top that I was just sort of amazed at how much they're doing to reduce their impact is the Coca-Cola Bottling Company in New Hampshire, which is a product that they're selling sugar water in plastic bottles, right? But the amount that they've done to reduce the impact of that practice is really remarkable. They had they had these molds that they made. So instead of sending trucks full of empty bottles that, you know, the truck's hardly hauling any weight, but the bottles take up so much space, they sent these little molds that could be packed tightly into a truck that reduced the number of truck trips from 10 to 1. So a 90% reduction in transportation.
That's huge.
So this is what I mean. Sustainability is a spectrum, and we're making decisions that move us in one direction or another on that spectrum. And so you just need to think critically about each choice that you're making, and as opposed to saying, is this a sustainable choice or not? It's more or less.
So, and what aspect of sustainability do you care about? For example, Coca-Cola uses a lot of water.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of people would say that's not sustainable.
And you could just not buy Coca-Cola, right? I mean, then you wouldn't be buying the sugar water in the plastic bottle. But, you know, if people are going to be buying that sugar water, I'm glad that the company is making the effort to reduce their impact.
Really interesting. And I may ask you a little bit later another question or two about the Sustainability Slam. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your comments, questions, observations like Sam just gave us about products that may seem sustainable but really aren't, or products that you wouldn't think of as sustainable but turns out they're making an effort. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And guys, let's go to Bill in Lee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. In regards to sustainability and recycling, there are techniques or methods to be able to convert all landfill materials to synthetic products, including synthetic diesel fuel and paraffin. And we would have some waste heat left over for heating a big greenhouses. And the question really is then, how do we get this thing funded? We need $50 to $60 million to start. And
so, Billy, I hear what you're saying. So landfills, for example, could be more sustainable if we just put the investment in there. I think there's a great example in New Hampshire, Michael, right, of UNH getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's waste to energy, essentially, and you're using the organic materials that are in that landfill. So that creates methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, but it also is great for heating and cooling. So they have a cogeneration plant at UNH drawing from the waste at the landfill. I believe it's in Rochester, and they built the pipeline over to UNH. And it's funny because even in that, what is ostensibly a sustainable solution, they run into problems with the dining hall wanting to compost their waste. So all their food waste, they say, okay, you're done with your meal. University student, go put it into this composting bin, and we'll take that and we'll compost it and we'll make it, some fertilizer or whatever we'll make it. And they run up against the problem of, hey, if that organic waste isn't going to that landfill that we funded for $15, $20 million, then that the waste-to-energy plant is less effective. So essentially, you're robbing from Peter to pay Paul, and you get the kickback saying, no, you can't have a composting program on campus. We need that to go to the landfill so it can then heat the buildings. And it's Sam, I don't know if you would want to weigh in on that.
Yeah,
how do you resolve that one, right?
I actually thought a couple times of doing a story about that situation. I've heard a number of people talk about it, but I haven't gotten around to it. But there are technologies that sometimes are both considered green, sustainable, all these buzzwords that are in tension with each other. And that's a perfect example. I mean, it's quote unquote renewable methane gas, right? But if you're composting, you're taking away from it. And another example is there's a technology called an anaerobic digester, which has been proposed. I mean, they're building all sorts of them in Vermont, where you take food waste and instead of composting it or instead of putting it into the landfill that's capturing the methane for natural gas, you put it into this thing called an anaerobic digester. It makes methane. And it also, there's a company here in New Hampshire called Great Bay Fertilizer that takes some of the byproduct to make a lawn fertilizer. So all three of those technologies are a way of getting rid of our organic waste that are at tension with each other. I mean, you can't put all of you can't put them all in all three of them. Each one takes away from the other one. So again, you have to be educated. You have to make these decisions based on knowing what the sort of waste cycle is in your area.
And one of the supposedly sustainable benefits of that blue apron that you talked about earlier, Sam, is, everybody has food waste. I mean, I'm, exhibit A here. I buy these giant heads of, who knows, whatever. And I think, yeah, I'll make a soup. And then I get busy. And then, another week later, my husband says, what's this at the bottom of the vegetable drawer? So I throw it in the composter. I feel a little bit better about myself. But Blue Apron says, look, we'll help you eliminate that food waste.
Yeah, with perfectly portioned products. I believe is their tagline. But that perfect portion is, of course, in the eye of the beholder. I personally am a little hungry after a Blue Apron meal. So,
And I've got a preteen and a teenager, so that might not work for me. Well, coming up, we talk with the founder of a New Hampshire company that sells environmentally friendly auto products. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, environmental sustainability. What's the real deal and what's public relations greenwashing? What do you think? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sam Evans-Brown, Mike Bellamente, we're going to go now to Glenn Johnson. He's founder and owner of Auto Be Green, which sells environmentally friendly products for vehicles. And Glenn Johnson, good to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Well, Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
What sorts of products do you sell, Glenn?
Everything from car wash and tire shine to motor oil.
So the products that really make your car look good and run good, if I could put it that way.
Exactly.
What are some of the ways that your products are more, quote-unquote, green than a traditional, you know, motor oil or car wash product?
Well, we've got a couple of criteria that we established when we started the company about 5 years ago. And we like all the products. Well, the products are all made green, they're packaged green, and they're able to be disposed of in a green manner.
What does that mean, made green, Glenn?
Well, we have, take motor oil. We have two types of motor oil, full synthetic and conventional. The full synthetic motor oil is bio-based. There's no petroleum involved. It's a plant and animal fat-based motor oil that meets all the manufacturer's specifications.
Wow.
Our conventional motor oil is re-refined. Now, motor oil does not break down. It simply gets dirty, and it can be reused a number of times. So between the two motor oils, they're made green, they're packaged green, and they're disposed of in a green manner. Either the packaging is able to be recycled, and I've heard all the comments about recycling, or the motor oil is returned to a factory where it is cleaned and brought up to manufacturer's specifications and then sold again as a twice-refined motor oil.
Who are your typical customers, Glenn?
Ah, good question. The bulk of our customers are a business, a school, a university that wants to be sustainable. Colleges, universities, prep schools, golf courses, landscape companies, tree companies, loggers that want to be green, sustainable. We make it easy for them and also affordable and practical to take a step to being more sustainable.
What inspired you to do this? It's kind of a, I have to say, most, you know, sort of green companies are maybe selling local apples or, you know, making handmade aprons or something. I mean, green auto products doesn't roll off the tongue naturally.
No, it's sort of an oxymoron.
Yeah. Thank you for putting it that way.
Well, my background is 35 years as a manufacturer's rep in the automotive parts business. And when I decided that I'd like to do something else, I thought, well, I don't want to really reinvent the wheel. As a child, I had a love for the environment, whether it was hiking or camping or fishing. And I grew up in a large family. We were recycling back in the 1960s. And I just thought, how do I combine my love for the environment with my background in automotive? And I came up with this kind of harebrained idea of maybe I could distribute environmentally friendly automotive parts.
What are some of the challenges in convincing people to buy your products?
Well, somebody earlier in the program mentioned lazy. And that's a challenge. Our products are the best kept secret in life. If you want to be green, they're the best kept secret in life. Most people think, well, I'll recycle, I will, I'll use a different dishwashing detergent and so forth and so on. But nobody, other than perhaps driving an electric or a hybrid car, thinks of ways they could make their mode of transportation greener. So I came up with these products via Google that make it very simple, very practical, and also very affordable, which is a key ingredient to all this. Green is great, but if it's twice the cost, people will hesitate. So our products are all environmentally friendly, practical, and affordable. So we make it easy for someone to take the step to making their mode of transportation green.
So is your product the same as a comparable non-green product, if I could put it that way? Is it a little more expensive? Glenn, sounds like you've worked hard to make it not more expensive, way more expensive.
One of our key ingredients when we started was we have to make this affordable. We have to make it practical. We have to make it easy for people. So our motor oils, which is a very important ingredient to the running of your automobile, or your lawnmower, or your tractor, or your backhoe, they all meet the manufacturer's specifications. They all meet or exceed, I should say, the manufacturer's specifications. So there's no worry about jeopardizing a warranty on a vehicle, a lawnmower, a chainsaw using these products. They all work Well, in addition to that, if you're in a logging business and you rely on your chainsaw, these products work great, and instead of that motor oil that comes off the chain going onto the ground and polluting, we have an ultimate biodegradable bar and chain oil that within about 21 days has completely biodegraded. Now, that's a no-brainer for a guy with a chainsaw to be using a biodegradable bar and chain oil.
Well, Glenn, last question for you. You said a moment ago that you've always cared about the environment, and so you wanted to do what you could. Your products are used in cars. You said earlier it's kind of an oxymoron, green products and cars. How much do you think somebody might use your product and feel like they're kind of off the hook? You know, they can drive as much as they want and, you know, never carpool and buy a car that gets, you know, 2 miles to the gallon, but at least it's got biodegradable motor oil.
Well, I think the person who's driving a car that gets 2 miles per gallon is probably not even thinking about being sustainable. So we're all going to be driving cars for quite a while. We're all going to be using lawnmowers and weed whackers and so forth. But in the meanwhile, we can be doing the most we can to make those products as green as possible. So the person who's buying a vehicle that gets kind of mileage is not really even thinking about green automotive or green for his lawnmower. The person who's thinking about it goes, well, I've got this vehicle. I really need it for the business I'm in, whether I'm delivering, say, Coca-Cola for the guy who's now making one trip instead of 10. The motor oil they're using in that Coca-Cola truck could be greener in addition to making one trip instead of 10.
All right. Well, Glenn, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Glenn Johnson, founder and owner of Auto Be Green, which sells environmentally friendly products for vehicles. His company is based in New Hampshire. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. Here's an email from Deb who says, I'd love to hear the guests' observations, opinions about Energy Star labeling for appliances designed to need replacing within 7 or so years versus appliances designed and built, made to last. Deb, thank you for the email. We should talk about these different ratings labels and ratings agencies. And Michael, I'll turn to you first.
Yeah, absolutely. And great question, Deb. What we know to be true is there's so many labels out there, and they're each meant for a different purpose. So you have Energy Star rating, you have Follow the Frog for the Rainforest Green Rainforest Alliance, you have ethical barcode. There's all sorts of things that folks can look at, but after a while, many of those labels just become white noise because there are so many and nobody knows exactly which label means what.
And I've seen some products that literally have like 7 labels across the bottom and all really small, you know.
they could be developed by the industry who's labeling them. So that's you always have to look at you have to follow the money and the credibility factor as well. But to your question, I am a huge proponent of finding that product that is built to last, and I feel like these days, I know for one, I bought an Energy Star rated washing machine when we bought our house 3 years ago. Well, that's great because I'm saving. So to be Energy Star rated, it has to achieve at least some level of energy savings in line with the U.S. EPA's guidelines for Energy Star ratings. This accomplishes those goals, but at the same time, within 3 years, it broke down on me. So now I have a washing machine that I need to dispose of and buy a new washing machine, which takes an exorbitant amount of new raw materials to do so. So I absolutely believe in investing upfront on quality products that aren't. So we have a term in the industry called built-in obsolescence. You might have heard the saying that, you know, Thomas Edison could have built a light bulb that lasted for 100 years. But the reason General Electric didn't sell those light bulbs is because they only sell one as opposed to selling hundreds over and over again. So,
that's a good question. And, you know, from a business perspective, mm-hmm. Why would you make something that doesn't give out in a year or two or three? From a consumer perspective, though, it's kind of maddening. It's like, I just bought this thing last year, you know?
Oh, well, you know, and marketing has become very successful in the last 100 years. And I think that while companies will invest in sustainability, that the proportion of investment in sustainability and sustainable operations is infinitesimal to the amount they're spending on marketing and getting those products into people's hands. So I think it's a bit folly that you'll say, oh, yeah, we have a sustainability department and their budget is $100,000, but our sales and marketing department is, you know, $100 million.
So maybe the biggest number one thing companies could do to make their products sustainable is make them last.
Make them last, absolutely, and have some criteria that says, hey, we're sustainable because we're building a good product that won't fall apart in 3 years.
Yeah. Sam, go ahead.
I think that Deb's question really gets at this idea of embodied energy, right, which is the energy that took to manufacture whatever product that you're working on. So when I make this decision in my own life, I look at what is the embodied energy of creating something new versus the energy that I'm wasting in using an old and inefficient one. And I think with every product, you get a different answer as to how long you should hold on to the old and inefficient one and how much better the new one has to be before it's going to pay off that debt you incur for creating a new one. And Deb, I'd say that without giving you any hard and fast rules, the first place to look is your fridge. They use a lot of energy, those old ones. The new ones use dramatically less.
I've got a really old fridge.
Yeah, think about it, folks. Think about a new fridge.
With some real old lettuce in it.
Yeah, or a head of something. Who knows what it is. But it's going in the compost after I get home today. Yeah, there's a little exercise at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center for kids where you put blocks in that measures the energy use of all the stuff around your house, you know, TV and whatever, laptop. And you're right, Sam, by far the biggest, heaviest block is the fridge. But Deb, our emailer, asked specifically also, Sam, about Energy Star. Does Energy Star rate just the energy that washing machine puts out every time you wash clothes? Or does it also rate the what you called embedded energy, you know, how much energy it took to make that product?
They do not. They're just talking about the energy that product uses. So the easy way to think of it is products that use a lot of energy constantly, day to day, are good candidates for being replaced, whereas ones that you just turn on occasionally, say your washing machine, might be better to hold on to the old one that's you know, built like a Soviet era tank.
Thank you, Deb, very much for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. We're talking about environmentally sustainable products. What's real? What might be greenwashing? And how we measure this, as Sam Evans Brown said earlier, it's a matter of the goal of sustainability. Is it reducing water use? Is it reducing air pollution? Is it reducing packaging? 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Beth is in Tamworth. Hi, Beth, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Beth.
Good. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a question, not so much with appliances, but, you know, all the junk mail that we get is often made of a variety of materials like plastic, paper, foil, and very hard to recycle. And I wonder if the legislature could adopt some kind of or introduce some kind of legislation so that junk mail, particularly that you're not soliciting, has to be easily recyclable.
This is such a great question, Beth, and especially nowadays, guys. I mean, no longer is it just a glossy flyer. There's all sorts of attachments. And during the presidential election, I think one candidate might have been
Jeb Bush.
Yes. Had like a whole dice that you put together, like don't gamble your future or something. So it's really hard to recycle this stuff. Sam, go ahead.
So really quick. So there's a great book that if anyone's who's really into reducing their impact should read. It's called The Zero Waste Home. It's by Bay Johnson. And when you read this book, she has all these strategies for reducing waste in all these various parts of your life. And the one that she sort of comes back to and says, I don't really know what to do here, is junk mail. So it's an intransigent
problem.
It's
so varied. And some of it has, you know, paper, but then it has a little plastic window.
Well, and not
so
only
you cut
that,
the plastic window out.
And not only that, but at this point, the U.S. Postal Service, a huge portion of their revenue comes from sending out paid mailers. So it's not in their interest to get rid of these. So it's really tough. It's I'd say something that, you know, Beth is not the first one to be frustrated by.
Can you comment on this, Michael?
I would love to, and I would like to say that Beth has a special place in my heart, and we need to talk offline at some point because this is exactly to what Sam was saying, where we have these some of these things that are at odds with each other, and again, economy, and it's my right as an American, if you know, not to delve into politics, but to make a living. And what Congress has decided is that we can't impede those people's right to make a living and say you can't send out direct mailers, even though you have every right to send out mail to everybody else. You can't send direct mailers. So that becomes everybody's right who owns a business. I can send as much junk mail as I want because I can point to the fact that that's going to make me money and help my business succeed. And it's maddening because – I'll go to the who gets mail that much anymore? I'd love to see a real letter among the 50 pieces of junk mail I get, and that's you know, that makes my day. But there is no, unfortunately, unless we get that legislation passed and we prove to them that the environmental degradation as a result of direct mailing is really a real consequence. And we have to just there are some things that homeowners can do, almost like a no call list that you can sign up for. So,
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So do a Google search, Sam. I don't know the particular name of it, but there's something out there.
A
no junk mail list.
That's right. I remember looking into that years and years ago.
It's not 100% foolproof. And of course, this book that I'm talking about, she catalogs her. You know, years-long war against junk mail, which included sending letters to companies that were sending her things, asking individual companies to take her off their lists, and she continues to get junk mail.
Well, let's take another call. This is Jim in Mount Vernon. Hi, Jim. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Go ahead, Jim.
All right. Yeah, my comment is on durable equipment or durable products.
Sure.
And they're great. I like to go for them, but they just cost more to make. If you want to get the cheap washing machine, you're going to get something that's going to die a lot faster than something that's going to last many years. I run into this trying to sell products, and everybody wants cheap. And if they look at the lifetime cost of ownership, usually it's cheaper to buy something more durable.
You know, Jim, this is a great point. And Michael, it's human nature, right? I mean, and some people are on limited incomes, and you may sit there until you're blue in the face and say, this washing machine will last you longer than this one. But right there and now, washing machine B is, you know, $500 cheaper.
No, that's exactly
it's
right.
Hard.
And Jim has it spot on. I tell you, again, as a green guy, and this means, you know, I do try to make the right choice, but I'll walk into Lowe's and the first thing I see are those energy efficient light bulbs. And yeah, I'll buy one of the ones that are more efficient, but not 100% more efficient, not the ones that are $24, but maybe the ones that's $9. So.
Well, thanks for the call, Jim. And coming up, a Dover brewery that works hard to go the sustainable route. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what it takes to be a sustainable business, to sell sustainable products, and as a consumer, how to tell the difference between a company that's going green and a company that's greenwashing. Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And Michael Bellamente, Sam Evans Brown, we're going to go now to David Boynton. He's founder and co-owner of Seventh Settlement. It's a farm-to-table restaurant and craft brewery in Dover. And David Boynton, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. Good morning.
Well, on your website, you prominently say, don't buy beer from strangers. What are you trying to convey there, Dave?
Well, that starts with just our philosophy around, you know, our goal is to build a resilient community through, you know, our craft beer and our craft food. And, you know, a pub, we're a brew pub, and, you know, that's originally a public house, and it's where people either start revolutions or get to know each other, meet new people, and really build community. So don't want you to buy beer from strangers. We want you to buy it from people you know.
Do you sell your beer in grocery stores?
Not yet. When we do, we'll keep it local. We are out at some other bars and restaurants, but 95% of our beer goes right from our serving tanks, 42 feet right to our taps at our restaurant.
How are your beer operations, David, more sustainable or more environmentally friendly than your typical beer maker?
Well, if you're comparing us to large national and multinational, definitely more sustainable, especially around the grain and ingredients and distribution. But there's also a lot of great local craft microbreweries like Throwback and others that are doing a fantastic job with local ingredients and distribution. One thing that we focus on is quality over cost, just like you all were just talking about. Really it's about, we're working with a new rye farmer to build the local food system and to connecting them with malt houses to get us more local ingredients. We just did a beer that most of the ingredients was from Maine, except for the water and the yeast. We work really hard at that. And then in our kitchen, we're a scratch kitchen. We do our own butchery. We bake our own bread. We make our own ketchups, dressings, aiolis. And we also combine our brewery with the kitchen. Our spent grain actually goes out to my chickens, which turn into brunch eggs. It goes out to Clark Farm that we get the lamb and the cow back into our kitchen that ate our spent grain. And it creates a nice cycle that's more resilient over time.
Is local always sustainable?
Oh, that's a great question. Local is always a more sustainable option. I believe that you can make some bad decisions locally, but when it comes down to it, an easy way, if you're just trying to get into sustainability, an easy way is to focus on local purchasing. If you buy from a independently owned local business, 2 to 3 times of the money is staying in your local economy. And that helps other businesses like ours make better decisions around being able to afford composting, like with Mr. Fox composting, and other decisions around that.
Have you ever been tempted, David, to buy a supply, a large amount of product that you need to make your beer from somebody far away because it's so much cheaper?
Well, the beer's a little bit different than the food. If we're trying to do a traditional German beer, we are buying that from Germany, but we're also getting high quality, and we're not buying from, a Monsanto or GMO product. We're choosing the companies that we work with carefully. And that's the compromise on the beer side of things. On the food side of things, we work with tons of local farms. We work with local farms that we can build the food system with. And they're facing the regulations that are a barrier to us getting good food. Under this guise of food safety.
Right. I'm aware of that. We did a whole program on small farmers feeling sort of beleaguered by federal regulations. But talking about cost and, having to do the right thing but find the right supplier, what are some of the sacrifices that you've had to make, David, to follow this path? Because it's clear you're committed to it.
Yeah, well, couple things. Employees come first with us. And so Josh and I, until last spring, we've been open 3 years. Until last spring, we were the lowest paid people in our business. You have to commit to it. You have to have wives that are supportive. but you also, you reap the benefits. It's, we may spend more in labor butchering our cows, but we're getting them at a little bit less cost because we're providing grain. And we're buying a whole cow instead of prime, paying prime cuts. We're paying the pound weight across.
Sure.
So it just takes some more strategy and, know, we're giving a better product at a Dover accessible price, you know, and we're making it work.
Okay. Well, David,
it just takes hard work.
It's a lot of hard work. I appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's David Boynton, again, founder and co-owner of Seventh Settlement, a farm-to-table restaurant, craft brewery based in Dover. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Sam Evans-Brown, Michael Bellamente, I got a stack of emails here that I want to read. But to you, Michael, real quickly, is local always sustainable? Because the assumption is that it is.
Yeah, well, exactly. But you could be doing anything local. And I think to Sam's earlier point, it all depends on if you have that ethos that's driving your behavior to be sustainable. With Dave, obviously, he's committed to it. But it doesn't mean you can't get equally as nefarious local, you know, non-sustainable products and build a widget or build whatever and sell that out of the back of your room. So you really it comes down to the person and the individual if it's more sustainable or not. And I know one of the listeners had a question about whether Amazon, which is not local, or going to your local stores is more economical or environmentally sensitive. So we can get to that in a second. But Sam, you wanted to jump in?
Oh, I just want to say real quick, I would strenuously push back against the idea that local is always more sustainable. And I think it depends product by product. And you have to look at, you know, just a crazy example. Just imagine you had an avocado farm here in New Hampshire. It would be insane. I mean, this is not the climate for it. In order for it to work, you'd have to be in huge climate controlled greenhouses, which are
using tons of energy,
fighting the New Hampshire winters. And I would argue that is not going to be a more sustainable choice than just getting avocados in a place where they grow naturally. I think you have to look at what products you're looking at, and sometimes this might involve changing your tastes. It could be that you know, okay, so say you feel really strongly about I want to have only sustainable tomatoes. Maybe that means that you don't eat tomatoes for a large portion of the year. But a lot of times people aren't willing to make the sacrifices required to make a decision that is actually truly going to be one that is quote-unquote sustainable.
Well, and again, we've had whole hour-long programs on local. Is it always sustainable? Examples like you talked about, the avocado or the tomatoes. So we'll set that aside for the moment. But it was good to hear from him. And you can just hear in his voice, Michael, the depth of commitment.
Yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
People in New Hampshire, some people like David are really trying hard.
I respect David for what he's bringing to the Seacoast. And there's a lot of folks, Jay McSherry, who runs Jumpin' Jays and is part owner, and White Heron. And there are some really good actors, I think, around the state who want to figure this out. And that's my role, is to promote the ones that are doing it and doing it right. So,
well, here's a great email from Jim in Newcastle. Can your guest discuss the pros cons of ordering goods available in a supermarket via Amazon? For example, I have a dash button for toilet paper. When we are low, I simply push the button, and 2 days later, more is at my door. So now I have a cardboard box to get rid of. But Jim says, I didn't drive to the store, and the UPS truck is out anyway and delivering. I'm sure other factors are at play, but I wonder what they think. Am I better going to the store or using my dash button in terms of the impact on the environment? Jim, great question. Michael, you first.
Yeah, so I think we were talking in the break because we saw this email come through, and it really gets the wheels turning. I don't know if there has been a life cycle analysis that says, you know, based on the amount of gas you'd use to drive to the shop to get that toilet paper, and that toilet paper was in bulk when it was transported from the distribution center of wherever it came from. There's so many points to consider, and I know from a matter of convenience, I shop with Amazon. And Amazon typically hasn't been known for their sustainability, commitment to sustainability. When I was wondering something called Climate Counts, they were one of the few companies, I think they scored a 4 out of 100 because they didn't publicly disclose their carbon emissions targets or what they were doing to reduce their environmental impact, and whether they were reporting publicly or whether they had a policy stance for environmental legislation. So the company itself, I I don't know where if they've improved on that end, but yeah, that is a very tough question that we should get some of the folks at UNH to investigate a little bit more.
Well, it is tricky, and you know, these companies, you kind of understand they don't want their product to break on its way to you. On the other hand, the packaging, Sam, a friend of mine from Keene, last weekend, she showed me something. She ordered a tiny part from Sears. I mean, tiny. And this huge box, you know, with all this. And that seemed a bit excessive.
Yeah. And I honestly, I don't have a great deal more to add than
what we've
already heard.
I love the Amazon question, though. What's
better? It's a great question. And it's one that's it's answerable, right? Someone could go and do a rigorous accounting of what are the carbon impacts or other impacts of these two supply chains. But I don't know. I don't have anything that I can really add.
I will say that anybody who's gotten married and has registered at Crate and Barrel, you have dealt with a lot of I guess it's like laminated boxes that even a steak knife will come in one that's a 12 by 12 foot.
Really makes you wonder. Well, we didn't answer your question, Jim, but we love that you posed it. Here's one from Adam on Facebook. He says, you'll be happy to know that the federal prison in Berlin, New Hampshire, has a food digester that removes the moisture and it comes about with dry pelts. I work in food service, and we are making a real effort to lower our waste. The machine is built locally somewhere in the seacoast, so it's helping the local environmental tech industry. So, Adam, thank you for that. Here's another one. This is an interesting question, too, when we look at, you know, living sustainably, sustainable products and so forth. This is from Jennifer. Could your guests comment on making old houses and other buildings more energy efficient versus building a new greenhouse? Now, Sam Evans Brown,
full disclosure,
I live in a house from the Civil War era, 1840.
And I just built a new
house. And you just built one. So who's better, you or me?
So
let's
this
be
is,
blunt here.
This is a great question about trade-offs, right? So my wife and I spent upwards of a year looking for a new house here in Concord that would satisfy – I mean, we're these – you know, environmentalism is sort of a top priority for us. And so we're looking for something where we could bike to work that would be energy efficient, that would be small, that wouldn't have, habitat impacts. And what we wound up doing was building a new house. It's very, very energy efficient. It's super insulated. It has solar panels, yada, yada. But it's new development.
And you cleared some land to put it there.
Well, the land was cleared already.
Okay.
We put it on land that had been cleared in order for them to sell this property.
I see.
And so it was – I wrestled with this. I wrestled with this for a very long time. I do think that generally – taking an old house and doing a deep energy retrofit of it is a more sustainable choice. It can be really hard to find a house that's a good candidate. It can be very expensive to do that deep energy retrofit, depending on the house and sort of how much you try to preserve of its original structure. It might be really expensive, a lot of labor involved. So, you know, it's a fraught decision And I'd say that it's one that you can't make real hard and fast rules about. But I would say that generally, rehabbing an old house is a more environmentally friendly decision.
Speaking as the guy who just built a new house.
Yeah. And you know, like there's lots we could talk. For instance, here's how I rationalized for myself the decision to develop that plot. It was on the market. It was reasonably priced. Someone was going to buy it and build a house on it. But by us doing it, the house that was bought was smaller and was more environmentally – it was more energy efficient than what might have been built otherwise. That's how I rationalize it.
That's a good rationalization there.
But it's not to say that this was, you know, a guilt-free decision.
I don't think there are any guilt-free decisions.
Nope.
No. And as you were saying earlier, somebody was going to buy the land. I mean, same thing goes for Coke. I mean – if there's a demand for sugary drinks, they're going to find them one way or the other. So wouldn't you want to buy it from somebody who at least has sustainable practices in their mindset? So
let's get one more call in there. And Henry's in Sutton. And Henry, I'm going to have to ask you to make it quick because we're nearing the end, but we'd love to hear from you.
Yes, okay. Our town taxes solar systems and our real estate tax, which kind of seemed counterproductive to me since the state and the federal government are trying to give you credits for that. I'm wondering how other towns deal with this and whether, you know, this is sort of the right approach for towns. And, of course, they're struggling with extra taxation needs.
Okay. Henry, thank you very much. Go ahead, Sam, real quick.
I'd be really interested to hear the specifics of Henry's situation, because in a lot of instances you hear sort of the opposite happening, where assessors don't consider solar systems to be worth very much at all, because there hasn't been a lot of proof that home buyers will pay more for a house with solar on it. So I'd be super interested to hear what he's talking about. There is something called PACE. It's a program through which you're allowed to pay for your energy investment through lower property taxes. There are a handful of towns around the state, higher property tax. Anyway, there's a thing called PACE. You can look it up, and it's a way that you can that helps you pay for your energy investment through your tax bill.
Henry, thank you so much for the call. And, you know, Michael, last question for you. Again, the Green Alliance, a platform connecting green consumers with green businesses. So if I go there, what am I going to see?
You're going to see businesses that we've sussed out.
Using your own judgments.
Our own accreditation system that have passed the initial steps to going green, and they're always on the road to continuous improvement. So we've taken the guesswork out, and we're pointing to the businesses that we know are green, and we're in the process of developing a new platform. Be looking out for it. It's called Naked Bullfrog, and it's really meant to be a mobile Green Angie's List or Green Yelp that allows users to essentially refer businesses that are on the right track. So we can't get to them all, so we hope that folks will help us find those good businesses out there.
All right. It's been great to talk to you both. Thank you very much. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.